League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Initial Reaction Podcast coming at you without the services of JP Cadoran this week. He is on vacation enjoying the post-4th of July week off, and we will certainly have him on upcoming editions of the podcast. So it's just J.R. Radcliffe. I'm from Lake Country Publications and Now Newspapers this week. Got a couple people who are pretty interesting who are filling in for JP this week. A couple would-be Olympians or prospective Olympians. That's Eric Sawinski, a Waukesha West graduate who was competing at the U.S. Olympic trials in Eugene, Oregon. He took fifth place in the 800, just missed qualifying for the team. Sat down and talked to him about his race, and also chatted with Garrett Heiler, an Oak Creek resident. He's from New York originally, but he's the jumps coach at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He lives in Oak Creek, and he'll be competing at the U.S. trials beginning on Thursday in the high jump. So stay tuned for those interviews on the local scene inside the state of Wisconsin. The Bucks offseason has taken some interesting turns here in the last week. Of course, as we speak, Dwayne Wade's destination is still unknown, but it sounds like the Bucks are one of several teams in the mix to get him. It sounded like they were on the outs as of Tuesday. The supposed Wednesday meeting between the Bucks and Wade had been canceled. Then Wednesday came and found out the meeting was still on, so there's a chance, I guess, that he comes back. What is perceived as a little bit of a homecoming. He's obviously very celebrated in Wisconsin because of his days at Marquette University when he led them to the 2003 Final Four. He's very much beloved here, from Chicagoland originally, but kind of thought of with a local angle by Milwaukeeans. I guess for my money, I would kind of rather stick with what they've got with Chris Middleton, who's a younger version, and I think next year could probably match Wade's output, if not even improve on it. And Wade's going to get a ton of money. It sounds like 2 years in excess of $50 million from somebody, and more likely a three-year deal from somebody. So I don't know if the Bucks want to commit to that, mainly because they pretty much have committed to a younger core, and they're not going to want a 30-something guy who's declining to be a part of the infrastructure of their salary schedule. But at the same time, there's sort of a buzz that would come with him that is useful in that it would bring some sort of veteran presence, which has been blamed as one of the reasons why the Bucks were unable to do what they did 2 years ago, and that's make the playoffs in 2015-16, a pretty disappointing season with that young core at front and center. So having maybe some leadership, somebody who's been around the block a few times, would help the cause. And more than that, it would put a lot of people in the seats who love Dwayne Wade and love the idea of having an ex-NBA superstar, or still current NBA superstar, depending on how you look at it, on the floor for a team that, you know, is in the twilight of its arena. There's a new arena coming. The current one is decrepit, and it's not exactly an attractive place to watch a basketball game, especially when you know there's something bigger ahead. So this would definitely bridge that gap pretty nicely and get a lot of people interested in the Bucks with their profile already pretty high right now in the city of Milwaukee. It would probably mean the end of Greg Monroe, who signed a two-year deal last year. They would probably not be able to fit him in the salary structure, but I mean, this is basically what Greg Monroe did last year. This would basically be that on an even grander scale, and that a reasonably big-time free agent in Monroe last year, and certainly Wade this year, would want to come to Milwaukee and show that they are interested in playing here. They do like what the team has going forward. And that's a big statement. That's going to attract other people. And maybe the Monroe signing last year sort of set the table for something like this if the Bucks come away with Dwayne Wade. I think it would still be a pretty huge upset if Dwayne Wade wound up wearing Bucks colors next year. It would kind of, to me, be on par with the Reggie White signing of the early 90s, even though Reggie White was obviously in his prime at the time. But it would be that level of sort of surprise, like the CeCe Sabathia trade or the Zach Greinke trade, the level of surprise and sort of mobilization of the fan base. Even though I'm not sure on the floor it's exactly the right thing to do, they do seem to have the players who can do what Dwayne Wade can do it for cheaper and do it as players who are still sort of ascending in their careers. I'm thinking specifically of Chris Middleton. So we'll see how that plays out. More, I guess, under-the-radar moves were their signings of Mirza Teletovic and Matthew Dellavedova last week when free agency opened in the NBA, and that was a big deal because those guys can shoot, and that's something that the Bucks did not have last year, a capable three-point option, let alone two capable options. So we will see how they fit into what the Bucks are doing in the next couple years here. They did say goodbye to Jared Bayless. He signed a deal with the 76ers, so that opened up the door for some of these other moves. It's pretty interesting stuff from the Bucks. Obviously, if you are an NBA fan of any way, shape, or form, you know about Kevin Durant. He is signing with the Golden State Warriors after spending several years, 9 years, I believe, at Oklahoma City. Definitely two different ways to look at this. There's been a backlash against people who sort of call out his loyalty into question, say he's taking the easy way out. There's always then a core group of journalists in particular, but fans also, who say, you know, how can you blame a guy for wanting to make a living? I have a feeling if we talk to JP Cadoran next week, he would fall into that camp. He would take that viewpoint. I'm kind of trying to take the contrarian viewpoint too and look at this situation and sort of say to myself whether or not it's fair to call it the easy way out. I think there is still some fairness to that. We'll love to get into that conversation with JP next week on the podcast. I'm sure we can also talk about the Brewers a little bit. The All-Star game is coming soon. Jonathan LaCroix, who's probably not going to finish the year as a Milwaukee Brewer, will at least I think, represent the Brewers in the All-Star game in San Diego coming up next week. So that'll be something fun to look forward to. Ryan Braun is on the final vote ballot, which means we get to find out just how many people in Milwaukee still love Ryan Braun. We're a few years now removed from the sort of performance-enhancing drug scandal that turned off a lot of local fans sort of against him. He's having an incredible year. His numbers are really, really good, and he definitely deserves, based on the numbers, to get to the All-Star game. But, you know, a lot of those guys in the final ballot deserve to be there as well. So in the past, we've seen Jeff Jenkins and Corey Hart come to mind. We've seen Brewers on the final ballot and a really mobilized fan base from the Milwaukeeans who love their Brewers and go all in to get their guy there. I'm not sure that's going to happen this year because I'm not sure how this city still views Ryan Braun, but we're definitely about to find out. So Eric Sawinski, Waukesha West graduate, like I said, ran in the 800 meters at the U.S. Olympic trials. He was the second fastest time in each of the first two sort of preliminary races at the event in Eugene, Oregon. He took second behind Boris Berrien, who did wind up qualifying for the Olympic team and was kind of considered the favorite in that event. Sort of an interesting situation developed at the trials, and I'll talk about that with Eric, about the way that the race started. It had an unusual start because they typically only have eight runners in the finals. They had nine this year because a runner who had fallen down in a previous heat claimed he was bumped, and he was able to apply and got into the final. And that led to sort of an unusual starting arrangement, and it might have hurt Sawinski's chances. He talked about that in his post-race interview, and I talked about it with him on the podcast. So you'll have to hear a little bit about that and what he thinks about that. But he's, even though he's not going to the Olympics, at least not right now, he's got an incredible resume, and he's had a very nice running career since competing for the University of Iowa. So give a listen to my chat with Mr. Sawinski. My guest is Eric Sawinski, a Waukesha West graduate, went to the University of Iowa, and is now one of the best 800-meter runners in the world, competed at the United States Olympic Trials in Eugene, Oregon, took fifth place in the final, took second in each of the sort of prelim races leading up to that. And Eric, thanks very much for joining us. I know there was a little bit of a controversial start on your finals race, and I know it was obviously a very disappointing finish, so we'll get to that in a minute. But now that you've had a couple days to look back, you were competing just a couple days ago in the Olympic trials in that Eugene, Oregon setting, which I know is pretty great for track and field people. I mean, how will you remember this? Will you look back and only see the disappointment, or are you pretty comfortable with that you sort of did whatever you could in your races?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was definitely a bit of a disappointment, but sitting down reflecting with coach and everything after the race, I mean, I did everything in my power to put myself in a position I needed to you know, be one of those top three and make the team. So I can't fault myself for how I ran, the effort I put out there, and you know, the result was a bit disappointing in the end. But like you said, I mean, Hayward Field is such a historic place for track and field that just having the opportunity to compete in the final there at the Olympic Trials was pretty special to me. So
forgive me for being a little naive on this front, but is there still any chance that you would get an invitation to go if a couple of people drop out, or a relay or something?
So there wouldn't be a relay. I am the alternate for the 800.
You are, okay.
So going into the race, they have a time standard of 1:46 even, and There's no chasing that standard after the Olympic trials. So the individual who finished fourth does not have that standard. So then it goes down to me. So I am the alternate.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, you know, hopefully for those guys' sake, nothing happens.
Sure, right.
Because they definitely earned that. But, you know, so I'll keep training here through August, September, and I'll be ready to go if need be.
Now, I operate under the assumption that the Olympics are the biggest thing that happens to a track and field athlete, you know, obviously every 4 years, but just in general. And I don't know if that's a safe assumption or not. I'm sure there's a lot of emphasis on these races, but I mean, you've held the American record in the indoor 600. You run for Nike. You've run in Beijing, won races all over the map. Are you training specifically over the previous 4 years for this, you know, this moment, the United States trials in 2016, or is there just too much sort of on your schedule to really even do that?
You know, this is definitely a big, big highlight because, you know, track and field's not really in the spotlight much unless it's the Olympics. Especially as far as media goes, and that's where a lot of sponsorship comes from is this year. But, we have our world championships every 2 years. And that is, the qualifying is the exact same. We have, you know, the U.S. championships, there's three rounds, they take the top three. So we do have that every 2 years, which is a pretty big, event for us. You know, if you call the Olympics 1A, this might be a step below or even just 1B. But I would say as far as hype in the media and everything goes, the Olympics is probably the big one there, so.
Sure. So getting to the start on the 800, and again, this will be a little bit of a naive question, but for people who don't know the 800, my understanding is internationally they don't ever typically do what's sort of called a waterfall start or have alleys, however you want to term it. Everybody sort of starts at the same place on the starting line. There's eight lanes to the track. There's eight runners in the finals. Well, in this case, there was a runner from one of the earlier heats, from a semifinal heat, who had been bumped and fallen down, and then he applied to gain entry into the final, was awarded that request. And now you have nine runners for eight lanes, so you have to stagger the runners a little bit since there isn't going to be that same amount of room on the starting line. And they staggered it where there were six runners together and then three runners together. Again, for people, I guess, who don't really understand that this part of the race, like, why do you think it was that they didn't maybe do a 5 and 4 or three sets of three? Because, you know, based on what you're saying after the race, this really made things a little more difficult for you than it needed to be.
Yeah, you know, I haven't run an 800 in a start like that probably since high school. So it was... it was out of the ordinary. I still have some questions I would like answered at some point with how that was handled. It says in the rules that there should be about 2/3 of the athletes on the inside and about 1/3 of the athletes on the outside. But, you know, how you want to define about, it's kind of up to anyone's interpretation. I also don't know how they seated all the athletes as far as, you know, seating in the waterfall goes, because usually, based on time and place in your preliminary heats, you'll be given lanes, and you know they'll give the top four athletes will be in lanes 3 through 6, and then everybody else will kind of be on the inside and the outside. But I was, you know, at a pretty big disadvantage being on the outside of six athletes, trying to go around the first turn all the way in lane 4. So you know I probably ran a little bit extra. I got out a little bit too hard, I think, trying to put myself in good position. But, you know, like I said, it is what it is. You can't change it now. So,
And for those of us familiar with WIAA racing, you run a prelim on the first day of the state tournament, and the times you record in the prelims, they correlate precisely to how you're seated in your lanes.
Right.
But you're saying there's a little bit more nuance to the process and for the USATF. Is there like a random draw or something? It's just sort of they tell you where to go?
To be honest with you, it's their rule book is like 300 pages long.
So it might be in there somewhere.
It is, and it's a bit vague. like, depending on what race you're running, a little bit of it has to do with, you know, how fast people have run earlier in the year compared to what they ran in the rounds and stuff like that. But I think the issue was that I don't think they reseeded the athletes after they changed from a lane to an alley start. And, you know, that positioning there in an alley, you know, if you're on the inside of one of those alleys, you're going to run a lot less than someone further on the outside. So, you know, I think that was a little bit of a bummer there, but what can you do?
And you said coaches were able to protest this some way, shape, or form, but it just they just didn't hear it.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, none of us knew they were going to run in alleys until we got to the meet about an hour and a half.
Really?
2 hours before the race.
Wow.
So, you know, when the coaches all found that out, they kind of went and tried to get that changed, but to no avail.
So for somebody who isn't closely familiar with the tactics of an 800 race, how important is it to get into that rhythm? How important is that first, you know, few meters, I guess, of the race where sort of people are in lanes for just a few minutes before things break down around that first turn? Like, how does that work for an 800 runner? What are you trying to do when you run a typical 800 race?
You know, a lot of that probably depends on the type of runner, but I personally, you know, I usually get out pretty hard the first 100, 200 meters and settle myself towards the top third of the field. And, you know, so that's what I tried to do again. But, you know, I think I had to expend a little too much effort trying to do that. And like I said, I put myself in position there with 100 meters to go, but just didn't have it in the tank.
And this seems like kind of a grueling schedule for an 800 runner, because you run back-to-back days in the first two rounds. You get a day off, and then you're running in the evening in the following day on July 4th, this was, for the championship race. I mean, in some ways, it kind of seems to the untrained eye, it might be easier just to run like in a 10K and only have to run the one time and not have buildup. I'm sure that's not true. And obviously, you guys are world-class athletes and can handle running multiple days in a row. I mean, are you pretty honed into a schedule like this? Is this typical, or is this more taxing than the typical meet?
You know, the schedule is pretty similar to when we have our U.S. championships every year. So every year it's three rounds. This year was a little bit different because the first day we raced late in the afternoon, I think it was like 4:15, 4:30, and I had to come back at noon the second day. So, you know, we only had about 19 hours. Usually they give us at least a full 24, if not a little bit longer. So it was definitely a little bit shorter of a recovery period, but you know, we just kind of adjusted training throughout the year to be ready for that, so it didn't affect me too much.
I love that you still list Wisconsinite on your Twitter profile, even though you went to Iowa. And my understanding is you still live in Iowa, correct?
Yes, I'm still training with my college coach Joey Woody. He was a professional 400 meter hurdler, so he's been, you know, he's been through everything I'm going through now. So just having him there as a mentor has been huge for me. But you know, I still get to put back to Wisconsin all the time. Big Brewers fan, big Bucks fan.
Yes. So that's what I like to hear.
Yeah.
The interesting thing that when I was looking up some of your times from high school, you won the 800 in the WIAA 800 meter championship as a senior, and as a junior you took 16th. So I don't know if that was, maybe you fell down in that race, I don't even know, but like, what happened between your junior and senior year? Were you a late bloomer? I mean, did you just take a massive leap forward in that off season?
Yeah, you know, I've kind of been a late bloomer in everything. I think, you know, between the beginning of my junior year, the end of my junior year, I grew 6 or 7 inches. You know, that definitely played a lot into it. I played basketball in high school too. And, my junior year, I broke my ankle about halfway through the season. So that kind of, affected training as far as indoor track went, and everything was just kind of pushed back a little bit there. So I suffered a bit there. But you know, it's just a lot of factors. Just getting more consistent with training, you know, had a really good relationship with my high school coach there. So, we set a plan throughout the entire year. And I think that, you know, all three of those things combined kind of just, helped me towards those goals at the end.
So you have a lot of success at Iowa. At what point did you realize this could actually be a career for you? Is it something that you didn't realize until late in your college career, or has it always been in the back of your mind?
No, to be honest with you, probably the last race I ran was NCAA championships in college. I took second. You know, the goal going in was just to make the final. You know, I had a really good race there, and I was actually applying to med schools before that. You know, I'd sent out all my applications. I had heard back from a couple, was going to take a couple interviews, and then after things went how they did, I sat down with the coach and we figured, you know, we've got a lot left in the tank, and you can only run for so long, you can always go back to school, so decided I'll ride this train as long as I can and see how far we can get.
I don't know if you've thought about this. There's got to be kind of a nice level of anonymity in this. I mean, you're obviously trying to get track and field as much exposure as possible, but you know, you get to be a world-class athlete without sort of the people following you around knowing who you are, with not having to worry about living a very normal life. I mean, maybe there are more drawbacks to that than I realize, but is that something you've given thought to? I mean,
it's awesome. I mean, being sponsored by Nike, they treat me so well. Get to travel the world, race all over the place, and it's never something I would have imagined I'd be able to do. I mean, obviously, you know, as far as things go, you'd like track and field to be a little bit more in the spotlight, just because it's something that, you know, it is really special to me, and I think it's a great sport. But at the same time, you know, there are perks of it being a little bit under the radar, like you said.
How did the relationship with Nike come about? Did they approach you? And I think has it been 2 years since you've been working with them?
So I started working with them in May of 2013. And
oh, okay, so 3 years.
So I was unsponsored coming out of college. I was working at a shoe store in downtown Iowa City. I was working about 40 hours a week trying to train while doing that. And, you know, that was tough. But there's a big meet that goes on in New York City indoors every year called Melrose Games. Some used to be held at Madison Square Garden, and now they hold it at the Armory. And someone dropped out of that race, and they opened up a lane and let me run, and I ended up breaking the American record in the 600 there indoors.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of how everything took off. So after that race, you know, I had a couple other good races. I won the indoor U.S. championships in the 800. I started out with a couple really good races outdoors, and that's kind of how that developed. I have an agent, so Nike approached my agent, and, you know, he kind of worked everything out from there. So,
wow, I had no idea there was so much serendipity around that 600 record.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like you do run better indoors. Is it something you feel like in your skill set that enables you to do that, the tighter turns or something like that?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of emphasis for us on indoors in college. Since, you know, being in the Midwest, you're indoors from October, November, all the way up until April sometimes. So, you know, I might be a little bit more comfortable in the indoor track than some guys. I definitely run well with that. You know, still in the process of trying to correlate all that success to outdoors. I think I've definitely taken some strides as far as that has gone. The last couple of years, so I think that we're definitely on an upward trend, which is pretty exciting too.
I'm guessing that you're pretty good friends with a lot of your competitors, and I don't know that will you be watching the Olympics? Is it hard to do that having come so close?
Yeah, you know, I haven't decided if I'll watch that or not. You know, those the three guys that made the team, they're all great guys. You know,
yeah.
I've had some good races against them. I've been on some relays with them, and we've had some exciting races. So, you know, definitely pulling for them. It might be a little tough to watch, but, you know, we'll see when the time comes if I'm able to do that.
I don't know exactly when the middle distance runner is considered at his peak, but so you're 26, right? You'll be 30 then for the next Olympic cycle. I'm sure that's something you're going to gun for, but I mean, is that something you feel? I mean, is that realistic for a 30-year-old? I would think that that's still pretty much within that range of peak, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, probably like 28 to 32 is when you see a lot of
great
male middle distance runners in their peaks. You know, there's a couple guys that have. In 2012, I mean, Kadivis Robinson is his name. I think he was, you know, 33 maybe a little bit older. So it's definitely not too old to do some special things. So I think that'll be the plan. You know, we'll try to focus 4 more years and see if I've got 4 more years in my legs, hopefully.
Yeah, so hopefully Brazil is still part of the picture here. Not hopefully something bad happens, but somehow something good happens and you wind up in Brazil. If it isn't, what's sort of next on your schedule? I'm imagining there's a little bit of downtime and then you'll start picking up your race schedule again. What are some of the things that you'll be planning to do?
Yeah, so kind of just taking a little bit of an easy week, and then I'll head over to Europe here the middle to end of the month, and I'm going to run a couple races over there. And then I'll probably head back over to Europe again after the Olympics and finish my season up with a couple more races. So,
all right, sir. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. Congrats on all your achievements. And bummer didn't work out at the end. Maybe it still will. And we'll be keeping an eye out for you over the next several years.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There are other Wisconsin connections to the Olympic trials, not just Garrett Hyler, whom we'll speak with in a minute here, but another first alternate from the area is Sussex Hamilton graduate Kellen Taylor. She was Kellen Johnson when she ran at Hamilton, a distance runner. She took fourth in the 10,000 meters, just missed a qualifying spot. She went to Wichita State after she ran in the area, and now she competes out in Arizona or trains out in Arizona pretty much full time. She just missed a spot and is the first alternate, and she has another chance actually at competing in the 5K, which is coming up on Thursday. She isn't necessarily favored to finish in the top three. She probably, the 10K is probably a better event, but an interesting thing to watch there is the three runners who finished ahead of her in the 10K, that'd be Molly Huddle, Emily Infeld, and Marielle Hall, they're all among the favorites in the 5K. There is a chance that one of those runners that, let's say all three win the 5K, or even a couple of them win the 5K, you know, win Olympic spots, Olympic berths, with a top three finish in the 5K. There's a chance one of them will choose the 5K and skip the 10K, opening a door for Kellen Taylor. So that would be interesting. And another thing with alternates this year is you just never know with everything that's going on in Rio de Janeiro. I mean, we'd heard about the Zika virus for a while, but it's really coming to light over and over again how the facilities are not ready, the infrastructure isn't ready, they have labor force problems, economic problems, and then you just have the virus issues on top of everything else, which from what I've read sounds a little bit overblown, but still not something to necessarily just dismiss. You might have athletes who decide not to go to Rio de Janeiro, and you don't want that. You don't want athletes to not be able to live out their dreams because they're afraid of where they're traveling to, but it is an interesting Olympic cycle to be an alternate. There are a lot of opportunities that could open up. So also in the 5K, we think Molly Seidel of University Lake School, who had a tremendous career at Notre Dame. She won four national titles, just graduated from Notre Dame, won the 10,000 meters in the NCAA championships last year, but did not compete this year after she won national titles in cross country and two indoor titles in the 3K and the 5K. She sustained a stress fracture, did not compete in the NCAA outdoors, didn't compete in the ACC championships, and it's very unclear whether or not she'll be available for this run, this 5K run in the Olympics. She's listed on the entries list, but not listed as declared for the race. So it's a little unclear whether we'll see her, but she's an area phenom, won eight state titles in track, four in cross country when she ran in Wisconsin. So it will be very interesting to see if she can sneak onto the Olympic team in the 5K. So and then like I mentioned, Garrett Hyler, who is living in Oak Creek, he talked about his experience at how he got to the Olympic trial, sort of a dream come true. He's 29 years old and looking to surprise some people and get into one of those top three spots in the high jump. So give a listen to my interview with Garrett. My guest is Garrett Hyler, the jumps coach for the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, who's going to be jumping himself at the track and field U.S. trials in Eugene, Oregon. His competition begins July 8th. Garrett just recently got the qualifying standard he needed to get into the trials, and I want to start there. I want to start with the process you followed to get into the trials. My understanding is you were injured for a little bit. You weren't sure you were going to have the proper standard, and you got it pretty close to the end. Can you just describe that whole process and what exactly transpired to get you to Oregon?
Yeah, definitely. So the way it works is at the end of the year, the top 24 jumpers or the top 25 marks in the country that have applied for the Olympic trials will get in. So usually that takes around 7'3", somewhere around that height. So I was hoping to get it early in the year. I worked out pretty tough through the fall and winter seasons just to get a good base. And I think I probably worked out a little too hard and ended up having a stress fracture in my femur from March. So when March rolled around, I ended up being out for all of March, most of April. And then when I came back, I jumped 7 foot, so my season best was still only 7'1". And I ended up going to a meet, local meet in Naperville, Illinois, with Brett, my jumper from Milwaukee, and ended up getting a mark of 7'3.5". So it just kind of happened out of luck, I guess, because I'd missed 2 months of training, and it only takes one jump, so.
And, I mean, that had to be just crazy, considering the femur, that you had a stress fracture in your femur, that you were able to do that. Is it that the time off actually got you a little more spring in your step, you think?
Yeah, I think the time off definitely helped my body recover. And then after that, I think it was just being healthy and being able to focus on my technique a little more rather than the training, and it all just kind of worked out, and it was a perfect day for the meet. There was a little tailwind, it was about 70 degrees, and so everything kind of came together at the right time, I guess.
Can you describe how the affiliation works? A lot of people that will be jumping will be from colleges who are, they're currently enrolled in college, and you'll see that affiliation when you watch the trials. You are affiliated with something called Zensa. How does that work?
Yeah, so when I was just graduating college, I ended up having surgery in my Achilles like the year following, and the doctor ended up recommending compression gear to help with blood circulation during my recovery time. And compression gear sometimes can be a little expensive, especially for somebody just right out of college. So I ended up reaching out to Zensa because the doctor recommended them. And sure enough, they were willing to kind of help me along through the early parts of my career after college. And they've been a great company to work with. I've been working with them ever since. So they've been awesome.
So are they your full-time sponsor? Are you able to sort of, I guess I don't want to boil it down, but I mean, are you able to get money to compete around the country through Zensa?
They definitely help with traveling, travel expenses. I'm not going to make a living off of it. You're not going to make a living off high jump unless you're probably in the top three in the country. And it's funny, I was looking at the start list, and I'm the third oldest guy on the start list, and I'm off 29 years old, so most high jumpers peak around 27 to 30 years old, and there's only three or four jumpers in that age category, so it kind of shows the struggle that the sport's had in kind of keeping their good jumpers going, because there's a lack of support.
And so I imagine because of your age, this could be your last chance at an Olympic trials. I guess I don't know what the shelf life is of any real track and field athlete, but we're talking obviously about people in their 20s for the most part. Did you sense that this was it? I'm guessing that you've tried out for things like this in the past. You've tried to reach these standards in the past.
Yeah, so in 2008, when I was a junior at Cornell, I missed by 1 centimeter. I jumped 7.2 and a half, and I think they took 7.3 that year.
One
centimeter. And then in 2012, I had a surgery in my Achilles, so that was the year before. 2011, I had the surgery, so I didn't come back quite as strong, and missed it in 2012. And when I had the stress fracture in my femur, I thought it was just going to be another occurrence from 2012.
What, you're from the East Coast originally, right? You went to Cornell. How did you end up in Milwaukee? What's the connection there?
So my wife works for SC Johnson, so we settled down in Oak Creek, just a little bit south of Milwaukee, and then I got a job working in downtown Milwaukee with a bank out there, and so it's been fun. We've been there 6 years now. We've been volunteer coaching since I got here, pretty much.
It's kind of a typical story in that a lot of Olympic athletes have obviously full-time jobs. I'm guessing you've had to get a lot of coordination from your bank, UWM, to sort of allow you to just take these trips. Although then again, I don't know if we're talking about anything more than just a couple days away at a time. I suppose a lot of these events take place on the weekend where you're trying to qualify.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the biggest part was the UWM track team. They practice usually around 4:30 or 5 o'clock. So to get up there, I would have to jump out of work a little early. So the guys I work with, they've been pretty flexible in letting me. I usually start work around 7 a.m. That way I can jump out at 4, 4:30 and get to UW Milwaukee to help those guys out and train myself. So it's been able to balance it so far, and my career's going well, coaching's going well. I've been appreciative that they're letting me have a good work-life balance, I thought.
Have you ever competed in that Eugene Stadium before? My understanding is it's just crazy to go see the Olympic trials out there, and I would guess a pretty daunting experience to someone who's never seen it before. Do you have any? Have you been in any meets of this? I don't know. Obviously, not this visibility, but this crowd, anything like that before?
Yeah, so I jumped out there in 2009 for the USA Championships when I was at Cornell during my senior year. It's an awesome place. It's a great setup for track and field. And then I was out there again this past June when Brad Pozolinski at UW Milwaukee, when he qualified for the NCAA championship, so I was out there to coach him.
a lot of people, I mean, they may know his name if they follow high jump at all in the Milwaukee area. A lot of people know Wally Ellenson, who jumps over at Marquette, who was on the basketball team, whose brother Henry was just drafted by the Detroit Pistons. And for people who don't know this process, why don't we see Wally Ellenson on the heat sheet for high jump? Is he not qualified yet? Like, is he not old enough yet? How does that work?
So the qualifying period is from May of 2015 through June 26th of 2016. And during that time, his qualifying mark, I believe, was 220, so 7.2.5. So he just missed by about a centimeter. I think his big jump was just outside of the qualifying window when he jumped at 7.76 in 2015.
So is it typical for, in this particular discipline in high jump, for athletes to get stronger even after their college years? I mean, is it, you see a lot of names on this list that are not affiliated with colleges. Is the peak high jump time maybe we see Wally in the next qualifying cycle?
Yeah, I think everybody I've always talked to says a good time for high jumpers when they all peak is around probably 26 to 30 years old is a good period. So he definitely got some life left in him, that's for sure. He's a great jumper and could do really well.
How familiar are you with some of these top high jump guys, the favorites to get on the U.S. team? And there's been a lot of discussion right now about Brazil and athletes being wary about what's going on over there. Has that conversation ever come up? Is it something that guys across track and field are thinking about and worried about?
I haven't talked to him about that yet. I'm sure I'll be talking to him about the to meet some good friends with a lot of the guys. We split hotel rooms with them and meet across the country. So, I'm friends with them. So I'll be talking to them about it for sure.
All right, and lastly, just, I mean, what are you looking forward to? Obviously, this is sort of this is heady stuff, doing what you're doing. I mean, what are your expectations?
I try not to set too many expectations. Just go out there and do the best I can. I know I prepared myself for it, so whatever comes along with it, if there's any bonuses, making the final round. So we'll see. We'll see how it all goes. I'm looking forward to the whole experience.
All right, sir. Congratulations and good luck going forward.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That'll do it for this edition of Initial Reaction. Again, JP Kadoran will be back next week. Maybe you saw him and I on the Time Warner Cable Sports Channel Roundtable last week. Probably not, since it was on Friday, and you might have seen it over the weekend or something. But my guess is you were enjoying the beautiful weather we had on the 4th of July weekend. If you did happen to catch us, you saw JP guest hosting. I was one of the guests on the show. I had the wrong time for when we were actually going to film that, which is a little behind the scenes, so I threw everybody's schedule off. Good work, JR. But one segment he sort of invented was Do You Care or Not, which it perfectly fits the aesthetics of how JP Kadoran talks about sports. I look forward to integrating that into a future edition of the podcast, and you can look forward to that. Until next week, thanks for listening, and hope you enjoyed our Olympics-themed edition of Initial Reaction. Bye, friends.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.